Welcome to our show today. We have just finished 12 weeks of a survey that's covered a lot of different authors, which some of them we have reviewed, some others we're getting ready to review. Made a lot of statements, read a lot of quotes. So now we're going to start to get into the weeds a little bit, especially the show today. We're going to be looking at a document. We're talking about a document that was archaeologically found at the beginning of the 20th century. But then they didn't do anything with it because they didn't have enough knowledge about the first century and the temple, Judaism, things of that nature. So as they read the document, they just said, oh, this is ridiculous. Everything about it's wrong. They just set it aside. Almost 100 years later, they dug it back out after they had learned some things about first century Judaism and the temple, and they were like, wow, this thing just nails it. This is impressive. We need to look at that document again. This is what they said. So, different scholars have examined it, and we're going to be looking at one of those that we have talked about. We've read a quote here or there. We refer to it here or there. This is going to be the opportunity. Listen to what the researchers, the scholars, have discovered in the 21st century when they re-examined this incredible archaeological find. So, here you go. Dr. Kruger, that's K-R-U-G-E-R, he's the author of the document that we're going to be looking at. It's a little over 300 pages. So it's probably not going to be a read that you're going to do in one afternoon, unless you really are a speed reader. There's some great material in here, and I'm going to hit a few of those pieces so that you will be able to go, wow, that's pretty cool. That's pretty interesting. You'll draw your own conclusions. I'm going to start with a problem that I have with this document. I know, it's crazy. Here's what the title is. The Gospel of the Savior. I'm like, oh man, I don't like that. I just don't like that because it's really not the Gospel of the Savior. As far as I can tell, it's not the Gospel of the Savior. But anyway, that's the title of the book. And as always, the documents that we discuss, the verses that we quote, they can be referenced from my website, which you've already heard in the opening. You'll hear it in multiple times during this 1 hour, two-segment presentation. You'll be able to read this, take a look at it. It's a PDF. You can download it. So, anyway, the Gospel of the Savior. An analysis of P. Oxy 840 and its place in the gospel traditions of early Christianity. I'm going to be referring to this document as 840. There's just no reason to constantly say P. Oxy 840. So we're going to refer to it as 840 when I have to identify this document. All right, so that's page one. That's the title. Let's get into it. I wanted to point out some things that this particular book covers. And I'm not going to say it's extensive, but I think it's pretty extensive. So looking at what you would do if you were to find a document, you dig it up someplace, and you're examining it, you need to figure out what kind of form it is. And in this particular case, it's a codex, and they talk about that. It's also parchment that is in there. When they're doing an examination of a document, they look at a variety of things to determine when it was written. We're going to get into that later. They have their way of getting into it, and it follows our opening section here. Another thing that they look at to help that, to help with the dating, amongst other things, is punctuation. So they examine punctuation in great detail, like enlarged first letter, spaces between sentences, coloring. Yes, they were using colors, points, breathing marks, lots of stuff. In this particular document, they even use nomina sacra. And so we know about Nomina Sacra. We know when it began. We know what it represented. We know when it expanded. We know when they added additional pieces to it. And this document uses it. So that right there locks it in to a particular time period. And he has a short discussion on that. For some of you that are hearing about Nomina Sacra for the first time, this is where they would take something like David, the name David for the king, and they would use two letters, and then they would draw a line across the top, so it's a horizontal line across the top, or maybe Yeshua, or maybe the Most High, or Jerusalem, or some other name that is considered set apart, that's Kodesh, Hebrew, and we might say holy. Two letters, horizontal line across the top, it's called Nomina Sacra, and you see it in the writings. You know what it reminds me of? When they changed from the paleo, and we're talking about the time of Ezra, when they changed from the paleo to the block letters of Hebrew, when they wrote Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, they did not put it in block letters. They kept it in the paleo. So when they dig up archaeological items that have verses of the Tanakh quoted, it'll read in block Hebrew, and then when it comes to the name, it's in paleo. Not only that, when they took the Hebrew and created the Greek, which the first five books is known as the Septuagint, the rest of the Tanakh, the writings and the prophets, is known as the Old Greek. When they would write it out as a translation in Greek from the Hebrew, they would skip over and provide a space in their document. And then once they got it written, then they would go through a process of ritual purity. They would get like gold ink. Then they would go back and write Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh in paleo within the Greek document. We found that in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So whenever I see Nomina Sacra, I think about those things and how they help us to identify this or identify that. So he covers that in this particular book. So I just wanted to mention that. Also, as is always the case, when you're trying to identify a document, there's going to be historical problems. And so you have to work through that. And an example, he has a list. And I'm not saying that all of these are a problem, but the first one sure is. What do we know about the high priest? Comes out of the line of Levi. Well, this document talks about a Pharisaic high priest. Needless to say, in a literal sense, that would be a problem. But here, what you're going to find out is that, in fact, it's not talking about a Pharisaic high priest in reality, but it is a figure of speech for a leader within the rabbinic community that is in charge of ritual purity issues. And the author gets into that. So that's kind of interesting as well. Continuing, other historical problems that he lists, the temple layout and the holy vessels. This is something that people did when they went in. When you look back at Torah, it says three times a year, men leave their homes, come to the temple. Three times a year, every year, they come to the temple. There's an opportunity to view the holy vessels, and this is discussed within this document. The third one that he lists is the ceremonial washing in the pool of David. This is, once again, getting into the subject that we discussed in our first 12 presentations, which ended, the 12th one was last week. It has to do with ceremonial washing, which is part of the ritual purity system, which we already worked through. And then finally, now I'm not covering all of them, but I just wanted to mention these. The fourth one I want to mention, the last one that I'm going to mention, is restrictions to enter the temple area. So you might say, well, wait a minute, the temple was destroyed in 70. Yeah, that's true. So it makes you wonder when this document was written. But when you read it, you will see that it's phrased in such a way to remember how things were so that decisions can be made now on how things should be. And it relates to ritual purity. And this is why I quoted it so much during the first 12 when we were going through that ritual purity issue in Matthew 15 Mark 7, basically because the author of the NICNT, he mentions 15. So we looked at it and worked through that. And of course, the final summary of all of that study was completed last week, which was week 12. Continuing, he talks about the relationship of 840 to the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, because there are passages that are quoted, or at least they're kind of quoted. Certainly the themes and other types of references are there, easily identified, the subjects. And so he wants to talk about those textual relationships, and that includes literary form and structure. Also deals with vocabulary, phraseology, and grammar. He looks at all of those things to talk about relationships. So that was a pretty fascinating section too, and you'll be able to read that if you download the document. As he continues along, and going to be the place where we're going to end up doing most of our quoting, towards placing 840 within the second century, and he labels it as early Christianity. Christianity hadn't been created yet in the second century. It was just beginning to be created, but it did not exist yet. So this is kind of an anachronism, but I'm not getting on the author. This is what he knows. Of course, recent archaeological research has determined that that's not correct, and so adjustments are going to be made, but that adjustment is going to take some time. To talk about the fact that there were no Christians in the first century. That's going to take some time. And I'm going to be discussing that at the Feast of Tabernacles in 2020 this year in Oklahoma. But that's another discussion. Anyway, he does talk about placing 840 within the chronological understanding of what was taking place from the time of the resurrection and the ascension through the end of the second century. We're talking about 170 years, plus or minus. And so it is important for this author to make his best attempt to place it within that chronology. So we'll see what we can get done. I'm going to be quoting sections of this book, and I'm going to give two sets of pages. The PDF pagination is different from the page numbers that are actually on the document. For example, I'm going to start on the document page number 196, but in the PDF, it's 205. I'm going to try to be clear. I sure do hope I am successful in being clear in naming the sections that I'm going to be talking about. It goes like this. On page 196, which is page 205 in the PDF, he gives a conclusion of the statement dealing with the relationship of 840 with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which, as I said before, is actually referred to in this document, all four. Here's what he has to say. 840 seems to demonstrate knowledge of the redactional portions of five key texts from the Gospels. Then he names them out there. Two, it's probable that the author of 840 knew the four Gospels, he calls them canonical, the four canonical Gospels himself. So that's kind of interesting because there's always this discussion about when did they become a collection. We haven't talked a lot about Marcion, and that's around 140, 150. I may have mentioned him. I'm not sure. I'll mention him right now. He created his own Bible. He took some of the writings of Paul, took everything out that related to the law that was good, changed Luke, threw everything else away. That was his Bible. And so that was not received well, especially by Polycarp, a Gentile who was continuing to observe Torah, was brought up under the apostles, born in 69, and he was a bishop. And so in AD 50, when he went to Rome to meet with the bishop there, Anicetus, which we did mention this, Marcion came up to him. This is recorded in, I think it's Eusebius Ecclesiastical History. He comes up to Polycarp and says, "Do you know who I am?" And Polycarp turns to Marcion and says, "Yes, I do. You're the firstborn of Satan." And I always think about that, you know, God is love. Oh, my goodness. Anyhow, So getting back to 840, and we're on page, what page are we on? 192? Yes, we're on page 192, it's 196, my mistake, sorry. We're on page 196, PDF page 205. He says, all five of the gospel passages have three fundamental themes in common. Ceremonial washings, what did we just talk about? Ritual purity system, first 12 weeks, inner versus outer cleanliness. What did we just talk about? First 12 weeks, that exact subject. Conflict with Jewish authorities. What did we just talk about the first 12 weeks? So it's like, do you wonder why I quoted this document? I mean, very clear, very clear. All right, let's keep going. Moving on to page 198, PDF page 207. He lists some more concluding ideas, and this is how he ends it. All of these factors lead us to conclude that the author of 840 composed his gospel, which is Evangelium in Greek, which is the good news, with a clear polemical purpose in mind, to argue against the Jewish authorities of his day and to declare the power and imminence of God's judgment on them. Where have we heard that before? We were talking about the Netzarim and the Isaiah commentaries that Jerome quotes in the 4th century. This is the 2nd century we're talking about. But in the 4th century, he's quoting the Netzarim's commentary in Isaiah talking about the same subject. And it's like, really? Now that's interesting. As you can see, yeah, as you can see. Moving on. We're now going to go to chapter 5, and the title of chapter 5 is Towards Placing 840, he says, within early Christianity. And as I said before, Christianity had not been created yet, but it was in the beginning stages of creation in the 2nd century. For page number, we're on page 199 is where that title's listed. So we're going to drop down just a little bit. One of the things that has to be determined is about who wrote the document. What community wrote this document? So there's a lot of discussion, and that's where I'm going to spend a lot of my time. So we're going to be on page 207, which is PDF page 216. Who is the community of 840? So he's gone through some introductory stuff, and we're going to start at point 2. And it says, Jewish Christianity with an intimate knowledge of the temple cult. That's how he titles it. And he's talked about this earlier in chapter 3. 840 has an uncanny awareness of the details of Jewish purification practices, ranging from the running water that Pharisees required in a mikvah to the changing of clothes before entering the temple. Given that many of these practices were elaborations and expansions of the written law, but they're not contained in Torah, this degree of awareness suggests 840 was written within a Jewish beginning Christian time period that would have known how these traditions developed in the first century. Pretty cool, pretty cool. Continuing, going to page 208, PDF page 217. Such specific knowledge makes it probable that the community of 840 would have been following three characteristics. Such specific knowledge makes it probable that the community of 840 would have the following three characteristics. One, it would likely be a community with origins in Palestinian Netzarim. He calls it Jewish Christianity, but it's really Jews accepting Yeshua as the Messiah, called the Way, called the Sect of the Nazarenes. We already went through that. Although it must be acknowledged that some diaspora Jewish Christian communities certainly would have understood much of the temple ritual from their annual pilgrimages to Jerusalem, the subtle nuances of Pharisaic purity practices, like running water, changing clothes, would not have been at the forefront of their daily lives, nor would they have been enforced with the same degree of rigor. Such Pharisaic influences were centered on Palestine and did not always translate directly into the practices or knowledge of diaspora Jews. Even though post-70 AD rabbinic Judaism retained some of these Pharisaic concerns and could have passed them along to later diaspora Jewish Christians, it is more probable that 840's community is connected to or derived from Palestinian Jews that would have understood these purity debates firsthand. Now, in that quote, there's a sprinkling of footnotes, which I'm not going to go over, but I just want to say that he has documented this extensively. And so when you download it and read it, you'll have time to go to the library and get these additional sources that you want to explore to learn more. So that's a very nice thing. Continuing, page 209, which is PDF page 218. A Jewish Christian community that has its origins in Palestinian Judaism and an interest in the details of ritual purity in the temple would likely be a community that has maintained an ongoing interest in an observation of the Old Testament law, the Torah. So that's what he's saying at that point, which is the end of that two. So now we're going to pick it up at three, Jewish Christianity in conflict with Pharisaic rabbinic Judaism. That is point three, same page. He says, the harsh polemics in 840, as already noted above, are not directed toward Judaism in general, but particularly the Pharisaic brand of Judaism. Yeshua is confronted by a Pharisaic chief priest who is enforcing his concern over the Pharisaic prescription for running water. In a post-70 AD context, such an opponent suggests that the community of 840 is likely engaged in conflict with rabbinic Judaism, since rabbis are considered to be the descendants of the Pharisees. Continuing to page 210, PDF page 219. Consider the following. The opponent of Yeshua, the Pharisaic chief priest, functions as the captain of the temple, who could remove unclean people from the temple and forbid them to participate in the Jewish worship. The reference to such an opponent may imply that the community of 840 may themselves have been removed or banned from their local synagogues. We've heard of that before. This fits for the Pharisees' words in 840, who allowed you to trample this place of purification? Thus, the author of 840 has chosen an opponent for Yeshua who would most resonate with his community, which has been persecuted by the Jews and kept from participating in the public aspects of the Jewish religion. And dance the whole day through.
Dance the whole day long. My day
Welcome back to the second half of this hour broadcast. We're continuing to discuss the second century document, P. Oxy 840, which we'll be referring to as 840. As you have heard stated previously, you can go to our website and download this so that you'll be able to follow along or read it independently of our study. Most of what we're doing is quoting sections that relate to the topics and discussions that impact the restoration of Yeshuic Judaism, but we were also addressing ritual purity and some problems that the NICNT had. We completed that evaluation in the first 12 weeks, week 12, which was last week. We summarized what we had looked at before. So now we're going to take a little more in-depth look at the documents that we quoted so frequently throughout that 12-week period. So we're picking it up at page 213, which is PDF page 222. This is under section 4. It says, the Yeshua of 840 rejects the ritual purity requirements of the Pharisees. Interestingly, he rejected it in Mark 7 and Matthew 15. So this is a continuation of the position that Yeshua takes in the extended oral tradition. I'm going to pick up that phrase right after that sentence. After the Pharisee insists on bathing in running water in order to be clean, Yeshua argues that he and his disciples have washed in the living water and therefore are already clean. Interesting concept. The actions of Yeshua suggest, among other things, a dispute between Rabbinic Judaism and the Netzarim over the issue of purity laws. Another thing I just want to remind you is that in many of these quotes, the author has extensive footnotes. Just, for example, right there, that was footnote number 54. I don't know the total number of footnotes. Probably over 100, though. We'll see. All right, so continuing, on that page at the bottom it says, all these factors make it evident that there was a serious division and conflict between the community of 840 and Rabbinic Judaism. Interesting. Although the causes of this conflict were surely multifaceted, the above analysis suggests that a decisive factor may have been the exclusion from the synagogue experienced by the community of 840. Now, we have not really got into that all that much. We have small the little in 85, and then we have the change in the Amidah with the addition. Then, of course, we have Bar Kokhba under Akiva. These things have to be looked at and in detail, but not today. John, the canonical gospel, speaks about when you are removed from the synagogue, and so it would appear that in this document that has happened. The community has been asked to leave the synagogue, and they weren't happy about it. In saying that there is a serious division and conflict between the community and Rabbinic Judaism could be an understatement, but it's interesting that based on the analysis, as he says, and I'm going to read that again, although the causes of the conflict were surely multifaceted, the above analysis suggests that a decisive factor may have been the exclusion from the synagogue experienced by the community of 840. Why might that have been? Well, let's take a look. If the community of 840 had rejected the ritual purity requirements of Rabbinic Judaism, Yeshua did, the disciples did, we talked about that in the first 12 weeks, then this may have played a role in their expulsion from the synagogue. Obviously, if Rabbinic Judaism is going to support the oral tradition and teach all the people, they collected all the sects except for Yeshuic Judaism, they collected them all together, if they're going to enforce oral tradition of the purity laws, but Yeshuic Judaism is going to reject that, well, definitely there's going to be a conflict. I mean, that just goes without saying. And I want to note that while there has been some scholarship that has looked into the separation of the Netzarim from Judaism in the synagogues, a lot of it focuses on the, I think it's 90 AD, where the Birkat HaAminim, and I'm sure I'm not saying that exactly right, there does seem to be a "we don't want you here," that type of attitude. And we're going to look at this more in the next couple of weeks, but it seems that Epiphanes makes the note, now I'm just saying this off the top of my head, that three times a day, they stand up and curse the Netzarim. So clearly, they were not pleased. There you go. So that could be what is going on here. And he does make this comment at the top of page 214 and PDF page 223. So now we're at section 4. Jewish Christianity, which opposes the keeping of ritual purity laws as a requirement for entrance into the covenant community. Now, this is crazy. When I first read this, I was like, what? But, hey, it became a thing, and I didn't even know it. It became a thing. So we're going to take a little look at this because I was shocked. I just was shocked. So here we go. I'm reading the author's quote. "It is clear from the discussions above that 840 central concern is ritual purity." That's the subject. "In particular, the setting in the temple, which is in the 840 writing, suggests that the concern is over what ritual purity laws must be observed for one to have legitimate access to God." Now, this is talking about from the standpoint of the temple and where ritual purity comes in, but Torah lays that out. Oral tradition adds additional items. So if Yeshua is untangling oral tradition from the written Torah, which we know he did, and he rejects some of these expansions because they are too heavy of a yoke for people to bear, Peter makes note of that in Acts 15, then there's going to be a conflict in the synagogue. You just can't escape it. So this document, as he says here, the central concern is about ritual purity. What's required, what's not required. Moving on to the next page, which is page 215, PDF page 224. "As noted above in chapter 3, which we did not read, but you'll be able to read that once you download the document, first century Judaism was characterized by an ever-expanding oral tradition concerning laws of ritual purity. Example, immersion before prayer, immersion before Torah reading, etc. Requiring early Jewish Christians to decide what role such laws played for followers of Christ." That's the quote I'm reading. That's what he wrote. And once again, there is a story within 840 about Yeshua and the temple and the Pharisees. So the author is bringing out a point. The continuing on that page, one possibility, although there is no way to be certain, is that the Jewish Christian community of 840, which is really the Netzarim, may have been engaged in conflict over the proper limits of table fellowship. The debate over table fellowship concerned how scrupulously the oral tradition, that's that extended oral halakha, concerning ritual purity should be observed by participants at the common meal. Once again, we address this to some degree in our first 12-week study. Oral tradition that is expanded is a heavy yoke. Torah doesn't require it. You want to do it? You can do it. But you don't condemn others for not doing it. That was part of the problem. So, continuing with the quote by this scholar, page 215 and PDF page 224, it says, "The Pharisees in Yeshua's day sought to apply the purity laws governing the temple to everyday meals in their homes." And we discussed that. And if you want to look at that, the foremost scholar of Judaism, a Neusner, Jacob Neusner, his book From Politics to Piety, on page 83, that's the quote that the author uses here, but he discusses this exact problem. Continuing on now to page 216, which is PDF page 225, "Since proper table fellowship continued to be a preeminent concern of rabbinic Judaism, it is the most likely candidate for a post-70 AD area of disagreement over ritual purity. And, of course, AD 70 is when the temple was destroyed. If Yeshua did not need to observe ritual purity halakha for the temple that was part of the ever-expanding oral tradition, then surely the Netzarim do not need to do so for common meals that the Pharisees patterned after the temple. 3. The concern over meal purity was a distinctively Pharisaic or rabbinic one. This fits well with the fact that in 840, it is a Pharisee who is trying to enforce the ritual purity laws. So as you can see, it's not really a Pharisaic high priest. In the past, prior to the destruction of the temple, the priesthood were the ones who taught and they were the ones who enforced. But now the priesthood, through the reorganization into rabbinic Judaism, the priesthood was eliminated. Akiva put that together. We'll talk about that one day, the role of Akiva in the destruction of everything. They got rid of the priests. That was very easy to do. And so now the Pharisees took on those roles, which they were not supposed to take on, but that's a whole other discussion. And so in this particular document, it is a Pharisee who's trying to enforce ritual purity laws. So that makes perfect sense. Continuing to 5. The ritual purity laws that Yeshua rejected were oral expansions of the Old Testament law and not a rejection of the Old Testament itself. Once again, we saw that in our discussion. Some people thought he was changing everything, but the evidence doesn't support that. It rejects it just solidly. In the same way, Pharisaic requirements of ritual purity around meals were simply part of the ever-expanding oral tradition and not part of the Old Testament itself. 6. Many of the canonical gospel texts that 840 was modeled after, remember I told you that it quoted from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, was modeled after deal directly with the issue of purity at meals. He even mentions Mark 7 and Matthew 23, both passages that I looked at in that 12-week period. Continuing now on to page 217, which is PDF page 226. If this suggestion is correct, and we cannot be sure, then not only does 840 reflect controversies over ritual purity at meals, but it takes a definitive stand against those groups that insist observance of ritual purity halakha is necessary for covenantal fellowship at these meals. So there you go. You have to do it if we're going to have table fellowship. That was a problem. Now, there were 4 in Acts 15. That's true. But they were Torah-based. They weren't part of the oral tradition. Peter says, why are we going to put the oral tradition on the Gentiles coming in? We haven't been able to observe it ourselves. I mean, we got a few things going, but we can't observe that whole thing. Why are we going to put that on them? You put that on them when they take the proselyte ceremony, make the rabbis their master, and take an oath saying we're going to observe all the oral tradition. That's a problem. So it was rejected by the Jerusalem Council. So here you can see that the author is understanding this. Continuing on that page, 840, while rejecting ritual purity laws as a basis for entering the covenant, still maintains a generally positive view of Judaism, particularly of the temple. In 840's document, it's Yeshua leads his disciples into the temple grounds to observe a key feast on the biblical calendar. That's 1.7-8. And the reader gets the impression that they came to worship, view the holy vessels, and participate in the festival as faithful believers. Moreover, it's important to observe that Yeshua is never depicted as breaking the Torah in 840, but he simply refuses to keep a man-made tradition of the Pharisees. How is that not exactly what happened when we read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? So you can see that in a sense, 840 is modeled after that. They're building their argument based on the reality that just took place that everybody's aware of. We're now on page 218. That quote ended on the top of page 218. which is PDF page 227. It says, perhaps 840 is a defense of their approach to the Gentiles by arguing that they and their Gentile converts need not observe the Pharisaic ritual purity laws in order to have full covenantal standing. So this is like a new thing, this covenantal standing thing. That's never been mentioned anywhere. And yet the Pharisees have come up with it. Now, I have not looked into the Talmud or the Mishnah, but I may have to explore that. I'm not sure. But this author is aware of it, and he's mentioning it because it's part of 840. Continuing on, we're now at page 219, which is PDF page 228. Some Jewish Christians insisted that to be a follower of the Messiah, one must first be a part of God's covenant people, which not only included circumcision, but also the embracing of those distinctive practices which set apart God's chosen people from the rest of the world, namely food laws, ritual purity, and Sabbath observance. Not only is such a position evident in the New Testament itself, but continues well into the second century, which is true. In Justin's dialogue with Trypho, he describes Jewish Christians who insist on full law observance for salvation. Irenaeus, later in the second century, describes a group of Jewish Christians who insist on law-keeping. Now, here's the point that I want to comment, not necessarily to, for, against this author. The Torah stands. It is the common salvation. Jude 3, I want to talk to you about the common salvation and that you should contend for the faith which has once and for all time been given to the saints. So if it takes place in the second century and it's new, it is not part of what God sent in the Revelation. We need to take hold of that and understand what we're doing, what we're looking at, and how we're being deceived, or at least they are attempting to deceive us with all of these additions. I mean, Deuteronomy 4:2 still exists. Do not add, do not take away. So I'm looking at this here. The salvation piece, that even that, in my mind, they've got wrong. Let's go back to Israel coming out of Egypt. That's in Exodus. The Most High saved Israel, brought them through the water, which is supposed to be a symbol of baptism, brought them to the mountain where they agreed to the terms of the covenant and then entered into the covenant. And then over time, the instructions, the additional instructions were given. So in a manner of speaking, you could say that the salvation event took place. They were saved from the oversight of Pharaoh. They were saved from the slavery problem. And there's some other things you could do too. But it's not about salvation. They were saved before that took place. Okay, whoopee, that's good. Then we're going to get into the covenant. That's very good. Then you have to be obedient for blessings or you get curses with disobedience. And it ended up that all those people that got saved lost their inheritance. So this is not a salvation issue. I mean, salvation is important. Don't get me wrong. But getting saved doesn't guarantee your inheritance. It only puts you in a position so that you can gain your inheritance. And this is discussed extensively in the apostolic writings, and we will have to get to that. But anyway, I'm looking here. This shows me that in Justin's dialogue, some of those believers, they just didn't really have all the dots connected. They just didn't. So I'm just bringing that point out just so you can know. All right, let's continue. We're moving now to the next page, which is page 220, and that's PDF page 229. Moreover, since the Jewish table fellowship was designed to emulate the purity of the temple itself and thus required bathing in the mikveh, then a story of Yeshua rejecting ritual purity at the temple would be a pretty important story of how ritual purity laws were not necessary to access the God of Judaism. That is his quote. Find out what Torah says and then go do it. Don't be concerned about the extension. We're going to get into that extension. It's coming up soon. It's coming up soon. In the next 2 months somewhere, we're going to talk about that. I know we're going to talk about it at the Feast of Tabernacles in Oklahoma next month in October. But as far as on the radio show, we're going to get to it. It's going to happen. So let's continue on that page. He has a summary. It's labeled number 5, summary. Here's what he says. By way of summary, we have seen that 840 best fits into a Jewish Christian context with the following characteristics. 1, it is an Orthodox Jewish Christian community. 2, it has a deep awareness of pre-70 temple cult, and thus likely, although not necessarily, has origins in Palestinian Judaism, maintains a keen interest in the law, and is not too far removed from the first century. Wow, that is heavy. Orthodox Jewish community, deep awareness of pre-70 temple, probably has origins to AD 30, maintains obedience to Torah, Acts 21:20, Yaakov to Paul, tens of thousands who were zealous for Torah, not too far removed from the first century because the temple was destroyed in 70. Continuing to point 3, it seems to be a community in serious conflict with Rabbinic Judaism, and thus likely at a time after the expulsion of the Netzarim and Gentiles from the synagogue. That's point 3 of his summary. And then point 4, it is a community that opposes keeping ritual purity laws as a requirement for entrance into the covenant community, which not only has led to conflict with Rabbinic Judaism, but likely with other Jewish and beginning to create the new religion, Christianity, Christians as well. So at this point, we have quite a few more pages of this that we're going to have to do, and there's no time to do it today. So I'm going to bring this show to an end, and then the week after, which is like a week away from the time that you're hearing this, that will be show 14. We will pick it up at this point and continue until we finish this book. That may take the whole next show. All right, so thank you for joining us for this presentation.